Here we are. This is Real World Radio on air. 3w.realworldradio.fm.
Towards a new international economic order, a new multipolar world in which the Global South sits at the center. Academics and activists analyze the multiple crises the world is facing today and the possible solutions.
Welcome, everybody. I am today with Sinan Eden. He's an activist of Climaximo. I'm also with Juliana Sena from the Transnational Institute and also co-facilitator of the global campaign to dismantle corporate power. And with Fadel Kabou, associate professor of economics at Denison University in Ohio and also the president of the Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity. Welcome to you all. I would like to start with you, Sinan, and I will do an open question for you. I'm sorry for being a bit difficult, but I would like to open this conversation asking you how you could connect agricultural products in a supermarket being with high prices, with farmers demanding in the streets and mobilizing in the streets, demanding support from the governments, with the fact of an oil company installing in an indigenous people's territory.
So to me, what connects these things is to be very direct and very blunt, that this is a state of war. The governments and corporations declared war against the people and the planet, and their favorite weapon of mass destruction currently is called climate crisis. So this is a deliberate act of violence. They know what they're doing. They have known what they're doing. They have plans. They have had plans, and they still have plans on continuing the same procedure. And it's literally the same people orchestrating the entire thing globally at this point. It's really, you can name, it's a very short list. And it's a deliberate act of violence, and it is targeted act of violence at the laboring poor all across. It takes different forms. This weapon of mass destruction, the bombs that are hitting us, they take different forms. Some of them are acts of soft violence and others are more Hollywood-esque kind of violence. So the rise of cost of living in many parts of the world is one of the ways in which they are doing it. The droughts that the farmers are facing is another way. The heat waves is another way. Currently, as we talk, several places in Portugal where I'm coming from, are on fire and they cannot stop. And so basically, we are currently at 1.3 degrees Celsius, and they are designing an economic structure and a governance structure for 4.5 degrees Celsius. So that is what is connecting all of these lines between food crisis, water crisis, energy crisis, cost of living crisis. This is a deliberate act of violence that is directed at the people and the planet.
I've read you saying, Sinan, that we are already on the hell's door, that we are already there, and we are looking what's happening inside. What do you mean by that?
So sometimes it becomes more visible and sometimes less clear. But basically, that sometimes it really, really becomes very visible that there is a gate. And this I can see just now from videos of yesterday of burnt cars, again, coming from Portugal. This is standard image now. You cannot run away from forest fires in Portugal because the roads are on fire as well. And we just received news from 2 hours ago that people are locked up in a church. Nobody can go there because the roads are on fire, right? So sometimes it becomes very, very visible like this. It also became very visible a couple of years ago. A third of Pakistan was underwater, right? So sometimes we see this very clear image. It comes to you. And sometimes it's still like it seems to be still going. So there is this, we are in a transition from whatever we considered normal to an apocalyptic state. But the apocalypse is not some sort of meteor collapsing kind of single event. It is this that we are in exactly now. So when you see it that way, is not as in some sort of finality somewhere and actually saying, okay, how would it look like to go from here to there? This is how it looks like. And somebody's doing stuff, like all across, people are doing things. I mean, people are resisting, and then there are other people who are doing specific choices at any given moment to aggravate the situation. So that is where we are at.
Thank you very much, Sinan. I think you've been very clear. And Fadel, now I would like to make the connections with Africa. I think we all, at least the people who come from the social movements and with a capacity of analysis and seeing the reality and not avoiding to say what's happening, we see that Africa still plays a role as it played when it was colonized you know, for the transnational corporations, for governments from the north, etc., Africa is still in the same place. And you say that, but I would like to ask you exactly, how do you describe the situation nowadays? What is the role played in Africa today, specifically in economic terms?
So I use the term colonialism not as a historical reference, but rather as a technical term to describe existing economic structures that persist to this day. And let's just, for the audience, as a quick reminder, not meant as an insult to their knowledge of history, colonialism was not designed for justice or democracy or human rights. Colonialism was violent, abusive, extractive, and all of those adjectives that people are familiar with. But it also introduced very specific economic roles that were imposed on the African continent in particular that can be summarized in three basic points, and we'll see that those persist. Number one, Africa was supposed to be the place for cheap raw materials for the industrialized world. We still play that role to this day. Number two, Africa was supposed to be the consumer of industrial output and technologies from the global north. We still play that role to this day. And number three, and most importantly, Africa is supposed to be the place where obsolete technologies, assembly line manufacturing that is no longer needed in the industrialized world, is outsourced to Africa under the label of partnership and development and cooperation and job creation. But effectively what it does is that it locks the continent at the bottom of the hierarchy, at the bottom of the global value chain permanently. So that persists to this day. So why do we today, in the middle of this climate crisis, in the middle of the world failing to achieve the SDGs, why do we expect the same colonial structures that were designed for violence, for extraction, for abuse, not for development, not for human rights, why do we expect them somehow to achieve the SDGs? Why do we expect a just transition to come from this current economic architecture?
So the SDGs?
The Sustainable Development Goals, you know, ending poverty, fighting poverty, hunger, and all of that. So the idea here is that if we are serious about all of these noble goals and targets, the decolonization of the African continent, economic, structural decolonization, becomes the prerequisite for democracy, for justice, for human rights, for development, for all the SDGs that we're talking about. So that should be the starting point of any serious conversation about human rights or democracy or development or the Sustainable Development Goals. And that's often the part that is skipped over. I said, come on, don't talk about colonialism. It's something that happened a long time ago. Let's be serious and let's focus on the present. And I insist that the present still has the depth of the issues that we're dealing with are colonial structures that never left.
And are there in Africa, in the whole continent, Fadel, governments that at some point would agree with that position, or it's just impossible?
It's a tough question to answer, because you do have political leadership that has the rhetoric of decolonizing and delinking and restoring African economic sovereignty and so on, even kicking out foreign corporations that extract, you know, from Burkina Faso and other places. That's an important first step, recognition, right? But it has to be followed by a coherent strategy of structural decolonization. What are the actual components? And it has to be followed by a recognition that no country on this continent can do the decolonization alone. But that's why when we talk about Pan-Africanism, it's not a nice fluffy word we say to each other in these meetings. It's the economic and geopolitical prerequisite for this transformation. And it's comprehensive, meaning decolonizing the mind, right? I'm not inventing new terms here. This 50 years ago, you know, a lot of thought leaders at the time knew exactly what needed to be done. Decolonizing the curriculum, right? Decolonizing bureaucracy, government bureaucracy, not just canceling contracts for a mining company. It's part of the story. There's a whole ecosystem that needs to be decolonized and transformed.
Thank you very much, Fadel. Juliana, now with you. So Sinan was saying we are basically in the apocalypse and there are actors who are being benefited from that. And then, by the way, pushing for this to keep happening. Fadel is saying, well, we need a process of decolonization because this process is still going on, still is happening in Africa. And then we have, well, you as part of the Transnational Institute and being the co-facilitator of the Global Campaign to Dismantle Corporate Power have focus a lot on the transnational corporations. So I would like to know specifically in this context analyzed by Sinan and by Fadel, what is the role played by the transnational corporations today globally?
Thanks, Jose. I think that we can say without any doubt that the transnational corporations are the clearest expression of the system that Fadel was describing. It is the actor that Sinan mentioned that is the biggest beneficiary of the system, and it's also its biggest, most diligent soldier. If you look at the 50% of the biggest entities in the world today, 50% of them are not countries, are corporations. These entities, they have no accountability. There is no system of control. There is no one looking at what they do and making them accountable for whatever they do in our territory. So when we look at how they operate in different countries, coming in and out with freedom, playing countries off against each other to see who, which country is going to give them more concessions so they can get more money and explore more our people and our nature, we see how crucial they are for the maintenance and the reproduction of this system. If you take the example of the people UDAPT, our comrades in Ecuador, Union of the People Affected by Chevron. Chevron went to Ecuador, they polluted their forests, they violated human rights, the communities went to court, they won sentence from their Supreme Court, and nothing has happened because Chevron took all their assets out of the country. So they're still there with a piece of paper in their hand, but no accountability for Chevron.
And Juliana, you say in the global campaign you talk about an architecture of impunity that lets the corporations to keep doing what they do. How does it work? How can you describe this architecture of impunity? What do you mean by that?
When we talk about an architecture of impunity, we are describing a system in which what I just mentioned regarding corporations having no control, transnational corporations having no binding international norms to control them, but also on the other side, we have them having privileges in the international system. So if a country passes a law to protect its environment, for instance, and we have many cases also in many in fossil fuels, including in Europe, if you look at these investments, the transnational corporations, they can sue the investors, they can sue the state if these laws are passed. And it's going to in any way hinder their expected profit. So we're not talking about a corporation going to a country, building a structure, and then let's say, you know, we just burn it down. It's not what we're talking about, and there's insurance for that. We're talking about expected profit. They make an investment, and if a country passes a law to protect their environment, and it's gonna endanger in any way what they expected to make, they can be sued, the country can be sued by the transnational corporations. But if the transnational corporation doesn't provide all the jobs that were promised when they made the investment, if they don't develop everything they said that they would do, the countries cannot sue them back. So this is the inequality that puts countries on one side, countries that in theory would have mandates coming from their people, to corporations that have all the privileges on the other side. So that's a big imbalance and an architecture of impunity.
Thank you very much, Juliana. I know that all the organizations that the three of you represent have solutions. I mean, there are people's solutions that are on the table that at some point might be for actors like the corporations, not good for them or not beneficiary for them. But there are things that can happen that have been created by the movements, by the unions, by the peoples, by women, by indigenous peoples, etc. Sinan, in your case, well, you are part of the climate justice movement. You are a climate justice activist. And I would like to, if you could share with us, what are the, let's say, the solutions or the ways out that the climate justice movement has thought and developed during the last decades?
Maybe I give a partial answer in the sense of, so topics, so when you say climate justice movement, that's a topic or an area which gives us an angle of looking at the same reality that we are looking at. And then with values, we get different filters. What I'm trying to say is that the filters and the angles reveal different kinds of information about the same reality. So I'm just going to stick to climate justice. So there's this justice thing and there's this climate thing. I'll just stick to that. And it's a partial part of reality, right? So coming from the climate side, I think what counts as a solution is whatever makes sure the result happens. This is what we learned. I think if the climate movement didn't learn this, then we wasted all our lives for what, 30 years, 40 years. What does it mean? It means if you want decent jobs, you create decent jobs. If you want to cut emissions, you shut down fossil fuel infrastructure. If you want energy democracy, then you expropriate the shareholders. So the point is, a solution only is a solution if you avoid distortion and distraction. So, and this is what, I think this is the main point, right? The way the system answers to a problem is, so the words I collected just on top of my head, incentivize, subsidy, offset, crowding investment. I don't even understand what exactly they mean. But they are talking about something else, right? When you say cut emissions, they're like, how about we increase the price of, and I'm like, No. Cut emissions, right? And also, so the same way, right? So basically, we have to sort of decommodify the discussion, the entire discussion always, so that we talk about exactly what we want to talk about and we make sure that the results are the results that we want. And I think, yeah, so what Juliana was saying also about this distortion is happening because other people with other agenda are in the room. Well, they are probably the only people in the room most of the time. And they want to talk about something else. And they are talking about this other thing, carbon mechanism, carbon markets, credits, you know, they're talking about something else. So to me, a solution is a solution as long as we are talking about the outcome and not about some other thing. I think this is what we learned from the climate side of the story, because there's a lot of this thing of, yeah, distracting the conversation about and make it about something else that that has nothing to do with where we started with.
Right, Sinan, thank you. Fadel, I've seen some videos of you in which you basically say you cannot solve the polycrisis that we are facing today with the system that created those crises. So the question would be, what are the solutions then? What can we done?
I'll start by building on what Sinan was just referring to. And if you remember, one of my favorite lines from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the context of the civil rights movement, which is relevant actually to the climate struggle we're talking about. He said something like, I have no time for the tranquilizing drugs of gradualism, incrementalism, false solutions, dangerous distractions, right? He was a radical thinker in the literal sense of the term. He wanted to go to the roots of the problem, right? Not operate at the surface, because surface level intervention is superficial intervention. It's status quo intervention. So the system that was designed, not by us, not for us, right? The global economic architecture was designed during colonial times for colonial purposes to produce exactly the results that we're seeing today, right? This is not a system flaw. It's a system design that's producing these outcomes. So we can't use the existing architecture to produce better results, right? So you have to change the engine of the system, its entire architecture, with all due respect to architects who design beautiful things that do beautiful things and all of that. So we have to change, right? Transform, not reform, transform the global financial architecture, that's the World Bank and the IMF, transform the international trade and investment architecture, that's the ISDS, the rules of, you know, not transferring technology, not allowing real development and industrialization to take place, the kind of discussion that Juliana was bringing to the table. All of that is by design, designed to prevent development in the global south, and transforming the rules of international taxation, which is, for the longest time, was in the hands of the OECD countries until 2 years ago, thanks to the Africa group and the rest of the G77, coalesced around taking that into the UN system, which is a process of decolonizing international taxation. It's actually being co-developed as we speak, right, within the UN. So that's decolonizing taxation. We need to decolonize the WTO, the rules of trade and investment. We need to decolonize the World Bank and the IMF, colonial institutions that are designed to produce intentional economic entrapment. And if I may, I'll give you one example. You know, pick any country in the global south that's in a debt trap today and look back for the last several decades. How many sequence of IMF programs, right? Looked at Sri Lanka the other day because people asked me about Sri Lanka. For decades, every 3 years, there's a new IMF program with a list of policy prescriptions to micromanage the economy of Sri Lanka. And yet Sri Lanka is in a deeper debt trap today than where they started. So if that's the result, if you follow this prescription and you're deeper in a debt trap, it has to mean one of two things. It's either the policy prescription comes from somebody who's incompetent and is failing, that's one option, or whoever's providing the prescription is engaged in intentional economic entrapment. Which one you think it is? I think it's intentional economic entrapment. Either way, it means we have to reject the economic prescription that comes from the IMF, from the World Bank. The neoliberal, you know, design that is imposed on the global south is designed for entrapment. It's not designed to achieve development or a just transition or any of these things. So that's where the work of civil society is to inform, educate, empower, mobilize, organize, so that you have a mass movement, like we talk about the pitchforks, well-informed pitchforks, that can push back against the false narratives and the false solutions and distractions and provide the alternative on Global South terms. And that's how you build the movement for transformation.
Perfect, Fadel. Thank you very much. Juliana, then, what are the solutions from the peoples to counter back this power that you described before by transnational corporations? What's happening today in that sense?
From the global campaign work, Jose, I think we can really very much relate with what has been said by the comrades here, because it is an intentional system and it is a design. So the work of the campaign is precisely to change the system and to change the design. And we do that in two ways. To change the design, to change the architecture, we build together with social movements, with trade unions across the world, proposals, norms for national legislation, for a binding treaty to regulate transnational corporations under human rights, being negotiated now at the United Nations. And we try to build these proposals from the bottom up. We do that with the communities, understanding the realities on the ground, also asking the question, what kind of development do we want, right? When we are trying to design a new architecture for a different system, we have to understand what is that people want and what kind of structures do we need to build to make sure that it happens. So the work of drafting legislation, it's not just some people in a room trying to, you know, draft some laws. The idea is precisely to engage communities and different constituencies and comrades from everywhere in the world to have that conversation and think about what structures, what kind of regulation do we need. And on the other side, of course, that is the design, that is how we draft the plan, but we need to change the system. And how do we do that? If we can have the most beautiful binding treaty tomorrow, the most fantastic and advanced legislation tomorrow, but if you don't have social movements that are behind it because they built it, because they believe in it, then we have a piece of paper. And that is really not going to change anything. So yes, design and system change.
Thank you, Juliana. Well, Sinan, Fadel, Juliana, we are coming to the end of this conversation, but I would like to open the space, the floor, in case you want to say something. I think we could speak for hours, and I will keep here asking you many questions. The three of you are really three super interesting people and activists. But we run out of time. But anyway, I would like to know if you want to say something before we end.
Just a tiny last observation, because I think it has been mentioned, but I think we need to emphasize that. The change is not going to come from the people that are benefiting from the system. We need to go south. We need to look south. We need to look at our realities, make our own concepts, stop using what they have been feeding us in terms of economics, understanding the climate crisis. We have to get our own terms, our own vocabulary, and our own strategies to change the system.
Fadel?
I will second what Juliana just said. It's the change has got to come from the global south. We're the global majority. We are the ones that have the responsibility to co-design and co-create a new international economic order, a new multipolar world in which the global south sits at the center, not at the bottom of the hierarchy, and a new global economic architecture, rules of trade, investment, taxation, and finance that are conducive to development, to human rights, to a just transition. And that work, as Juliana said, is not going to be done by those who benefit from the existing architecture. So we have to build the parallel architecture, the alternative architecture, from the ground up. And it starts with meetings like the meeting we're having here, where we have frontline communities sitting with colleagues from around the world, co-learning from each other in a reciprocal way, co-thinking, co-designing, you know, co-dreaming about this new system design that we want to put in place.
Thank you very much to the three of you.
Here we are. This is Real World Radio on air. 3w.realworldradio.fm.